Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. American attitudes and laws surrounding marijuana have been changing in recent years. So far, 19 states have fully legalized weed, with 37 others allowing its medical use. The federal government still hasn't taken steps to legalize or decriminalize cannabis, nor have North or South Carolina, although Virginia became the first southern state to pass a bill legalizing its recreational use last year. Our two states still do not have a medical marijuana program. However, in the upcoming short session, there may be another attempt in North Carolina's legislature to change that, as there is in South Carolina. So let's talk about these shifting attitudes, why the South and the federal government appear to be lagging behind popular opinion, and at where all this is headed. Natalie Fertig is a federal cannabis policy reporter for Politico. She is here with Mona Zhang, who covers state cannabis policies for Politico. Good morning to both of you. Natalie, good morning.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Mona, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And North Carolina State Senator Paul Lowe is also with us. He is a Democrat from Forsyth County, which includes Winston-Salem, who is the primary sponsor of the North Carolina Compassionate Care Act, which would legalize this drug's medical use in the state. Thank you, Senator, for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Natalie, I'm going to start with you. These stories have been taking, the states have been taking different positions on the decriminalization and legalization of pot and for recreational and medicinal use. But all of this, even when they decide we're going to go ahead and do this, all of it is against federal law. So why hasn't federal law trumped state law in all of those places?
Well, you know, it was kind of an experiment. There have not been a lot of times in the United States where states have fully gone in violation of the federal government in terms of creating a new economy and regulating a product. Obviously, states have led on some other issues, the most recent and most memorable being gay marriage in the last decade. And I think that this is sort of similar to that, but then so much more, right? So you have the criminal justice reform aspects of cannabis policy and changing cannabis policy. And then you also have, you're creating businesses and jobs and you must tax and regulate those. So it's actually a very complicated thing to do. I think that states have the benefit, one, of having ballot measures. That's really what did this the first time in Colorado and in Washington state back in 2012. Most lawmakers, both on the state level there, didn't want this to happen, but the voters said, let's do this. And then the federal government decided, you know, we're not going to go in and deny the will of the voters in these states. And once that precedent was set, they couldn't go in and deny the will of the voters in any states. So that's kind of what brought us to where we are now. On Capitol Hill, they're considering a couple different bills, but the thing that you have to remember that I'm always trying to tell people is federal policy moves much, much slower than state policy. And part of that is because the federal government does not go back and revisit policy nearly as often as state governments do. So once the federal government passes this bill, it's not going to change for a long time. And so I know there's a lot of frustration. There have been a lot of promises and deadlines that have been missed by Democrats on Capitol Hill in DC this year. But part of that is because this is a very, very complex topic. Yeah. When you're talking about things from, you know, how do we test for drug drivers? How do we make sure that kids don't have increased access to this because of legalization? How do we, you know, make sure that we are setting a tax rate that both will bring in revenue to the federal government and pay for the additional oversight, but isn't going to stifle small businesses, especially small businesses owned by minorities and veterans and people of color, a lot of which are the focus for a lot of Democrats of trying to, you know, make this a great place for them to start new small businesses. So it's a really, really complicated topic. Yeah. I know that's not a great answer for a lot of people, because a lot of people are really frustrated that the federal government still is not changing this. But it's not as simple as waving a wand and removing it from the Controlled Substances Act, because honestly, that would create an inordinate amount of headaches around the country if it were just as simple as it not being federally illegal.
And many of the things that you just brought up, we're going to spend some time talking about as we go through this hour. Mona, you cover the actions of various states around the country where it comes to this kind of cannabis policy. And I know that the southern states have tended to lag other parts of the country in terms of what their state governments are doing with this. What about the citizenry? How are voters? Where are they in the southern states? Are they fundamentally in favor of the legalization or decriminalization of marijuana, or are they also lagging other parts of the country?
I think, especially with voters in more conservative states, I think they are ahead, but by and large, they're ahead of the legislatures on this issue. I mean, we saw Mississippi voters, more than 70% of Mississippi voters voted to legalize medical cannabis in 2020. And even though the state Supreme Court subsequently tossed out that law, the legislature decided to pass its own medical marijuana bill because they wanted to, you know, respect the will of the voters. With adult use, it's a little bit, you know, definitely more resistance, I think, among conservative states. However, we saw in 2020, very red states like Montana and South Dakota pass recreational legalization initiatives by pretty large margins. You know, it passed in 54% in South Dakota, which I think surprised a lot of advocates.
And in states where these measures are being passed and this drug is being legalized for medical or recreational use, or at the very least decriminalized, is that fundamentally being driven by voters?
It has. In the U.S., it has been driven by voters at the ballot box, because you saw the earliest states to legalize were all at the ballot box. And even in blue states, the sort of trend started through the ballot box. And then it was sort of like in the states that didn't have citizen referendums, they started to catch up later. You know, even though New York is a very liberal state, you know, New York did not legalize until many years after California or Colorado, because we didn't have an avenue for that. If it were on the ballot, there was no doubt that a lot of eastern states would have legalized a lot earlier. And now that sort of shift you start to see in more conservative states. So 2020 was the first year that you saw recreational initiatives in red states like Montana and South Dakota. And I think it was kind of like a test for a lot of legalization advocates to see if they could win on the ballot in these red states. And they saw that they could, and the voters really did respond.
North Carolina State Senator Paul Lowe is with us. He has a bill going through the North Carolina legislature right now, and it's not the first one to try to make its way through the legislature. We've had Mecklenburg County Representative Kelly Alexander on this program, Senator, several times in the past, trying to talk about his bill, which has not made it through. Why do you believe, and I'm assuming that you do believe, that your bill has a better chance?
Without a doubt, Senator Bill Rabin is the major catalyst on this bill. And as the rules chair, he brings a lot of weight to bringing a medical cannabis bill to the forefront. It's gone through several committees, and we feel very, very confident about this bill. It doesn't do everything we would desire for it to do, and it certainly isn't a perfect bill, but it's a great place for us to get started here in North Carolina.
You mentioned Senator Rabin, and for those of us who live in the great state of Mecklenburg, we don't pay much attention to Raleigh, as you may know, so we may not be familiar with him, but he holds a very important position there, and he is a veterinarian, so he's a medical guy. And he says this bill has been one of the most vetted pieces of legislation this biennium. Will that influence any naysayers in the legislature, or at least in the Senate?
I think so. It has been vetted more than any bill that I remember since I've been there for the last 7 years, and I haven't seen a bill that has been vetted any more than this particular bill. So I think that there is truth in that, without a doubt. And I've been there in these committee meetings, standing next to him, and we've talked about it and heard all kinds of things. But I think it's good for our citizens. And I think that this is a great great thing that we're looking at, and I think it's an important piece of legislation.
You're a Democrat. He's a Republican. I believe the other co-sponsor is also a Republican. So wonder of wonders, miracle of miracles, it has bipartisan support here. Tell us what your bill proposes. What would it do?
I mean, this is a medical marijuana bill. It is not a recreational bill, which a lot of people want it to be recreational, and it's not designed to be that. It models very closely the medical marijuana bill that was done, or cannabis bill done in Utah. And what it seeks to do is provide access to individuals with various conditions, you know, cancer, you know,
PTSD.
PTSD. Yeah. We use acronyms so much, I get them all flimmed up sometimes. But, and those are just a few of the things, but it seeks to deal with various conditions. Now, does it deal with every condition that everybody feels like should be on here? The answer is no. And whatever your condition is, it's probably the most important condition. But it's a beginning to start looking at what we can do to help our citizens. Other states are doing it, and we have to consider it here in North Carolina. I think that that's the reason we're doing it, and we brought this bill forward.
You're bringing this bill up during the so-called short session, which has been known in the past to go long, but do you think you'll have enough time to get this through the Senate and or the House?
We're going to do everything we can to get this bill passed.
So if you passed it through the Senate, and it appears maybe that you have the support to do that, given the profile of Senator Rabin in the Senate, can you easily get it through the House and to the governor's desk, do you think?
I don't know that any bill in the North Carolina General Assembly passes easily. But we're going to do everything we can to get it out of the Senate and through the House and to the governor's desk.
You are, in addition to being a state senator, you're a member of the clergy. You are the pastor of the Shiloh Baptist Church in Winston-Salem.
Yes.
And there are many people in and out of the faith community who view drugs as a sin at worst and as unsavory at best. And that anything that lessens restrictions is opening the door to abuse and will be harmful ultimately to individuals and families and communities. What's your response to that?
I think that one of the most dastardly things we have seen is the use of opiates. Opiates have been misused in the medical community, sometimes by fault, sometimes not. I think that we use those things in our medical technology. We use them. We use painkillers. We use all of these things almost in every operation and in every procedure. And while we're using a lot of these different opiate-based medicines, I'm not a medical person, so I'm searching for the right words to use here. Some of them do really good things to help people, and some of them end up doing very, very bad things. And I think that we have to explore all vehicles. I'll wrap it up.
And to use them as you would use other drugs under a doctor's supervision. We have to take a break. We'll come back, talk more about that and many other things with our three guests here when Charlotte Talks continues on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. I'm Mike Collins, along with Natalie Fertig, who covers federal cannabis policy for Politico, Mona Zhang, who covers state cannabis policy for that same publication, Politico, and State Senator Paul Lowe from Forsyth County, who, along with several other senators, has a bill working its way through the state Senate that would legalize the medical use of cannabis in North Carolina. An Emerson poll, Senator, conducted in early April shows that 68% of North Carolinians support legalizing medical marijuana. And the Survey USA poll found that 72% of North Carolinians support medical marijuana legalization, while 46% favor legalizing its recreational use, with 43% opposed. So there's serious opposition to legalizing it for recreational, but not for medical use. Do numbers like that surrounding the medical use of marijuana hold any sway in your august body?
I would like to think so. I see it as another tool for our medical community. And I think under doctor supervision, used properly, it probably can help a whole lot of people and a whole lot of North Carolinians. That's my personal feeling on it. But I'm not a
Mona, as minds have been changing among citizenry around the country, and as state governments have taken up and considered legalizing various forms of marijuana for various purposes, has it been a tough fight in those legislative bodies around the country? Or once the dam seems to be breaking, is it easy to get it through in most of those cases? Has it been easy?
It's been very difficult in most cases. It's very difficult to pass cannabis legislation just because it's such a complex piece of legislation that you have to pass, because it touches on so many different aspects of the government. You know, when you're talking about cannabis legalization, you're talking about criminal justice reform aspects. You're talking about, you know, how are you going to regulate a new market? Are you going to set up a new agency? If it's a medical cannabis program, a lot of times it's overseen by the health department. You have to think about, you know, how you're going to license physicians to recommend the drug. What kind of training physicians do you need to do? Physicians have to, you know, take to be able to recommend the drug. What about pharmacists? You know, some states require pharmacists to be staffers at medical cannabis dispensaries. It gets very complicated very fast. So even if most lawmakers or most of the public support legalization, sometimes it's very hard to get all lawmakers on board with one piece of legislation, which is why it's much easier to pass at the ballot box than it is through a legislative body.
We have a question, Natalie, from, well, not even a question, just an ask from Philip on Twitter, who says, please make a distinction between legalizing and decriminalizing marijuana. I thought that might be understood, but perhaps it is not. So explain the difference.
Yeah, you know, I think it's actually a really great question, Philip, because those are different things at the state and federal level. There are a number of states that have decriminalized cannabis use. Also, cities and counties have decriminalized cannabis use. And what that means, with some small variations, is that someone can possess and consume cannabis in small amounts and not face a misdemeanor or a felony penalty. So in some places, there is a citation, sort of like public intoxication. Different places have still put some parameters on that. Like, you can't do it, but we're not going to send you to jail for it. But on the federal level, decriminalization is completely different. It does not mean that it just removes cannabis from the Controlled Substances Act, which would then allow states to go ahead and choose to legalize and regulate it. So it's, you know, when President Biden talks about decriminalization, federal decriminalization is a different thing from if North Carolina decriminalized cannabis. Because if North Carolina decriminalizes cannabis, it's still a federally illegal substance. Mm-hmm. I hope that makes sense.
And the federal government classifies it right up there with heroin. Is that part of the problem? I mean, we've, since the 1920s, I guess, the dawn of talking motion pictures, there has been this impression that the use of marijuana leads to craziness and all kinds of stuff that is simply not true. But it's there. It's out there in the zeitgeist. And if you classify a drug along with heroin, which we do know has horrible effects on people and can lead to death, and certainly serious addiction, is that part of the problem moving forward on this, even for medical use?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that you very much see, both at the state and the federal level, is there is a strong age difference in support for marijuana. And a lot of the generations that lived through DARE and Say No to Drugs, especially people who are white and were not, did not see as much of the criminalization of that inflicted upon their own day-to-day lives, see cannabis as more of a reefer madness or a scary thing. It's hard to change your mind on something that you've been told is bad and to not do your entire life. So you see younger lawmakers, for example, South Carolina's Representative Nancy Mace. She was part of the South Carolina State House and she introduced a medical marijuana bill there. She's now at the federal level and she has introduced a full federal decriminalization bill. She's a younger lawmaker. And so she, from a southern state that doesn't even have medical marijuana, is a bigger proponent of this on Capitol Hill than, say, Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, who's a liberal, but she's of a much, much older generation. And of course, across the board, that's not, you know, you've got Senator Schumer, who would be an older generation and is in support. You've got younger lawmakers who say, no way, Jose. But, you know, you've got a very big age divide on that. And I think that really comes from what you were talking about with the movies from the 1920s, with, you know, Nancy Reagan's Say No to Drugs effort in the 80s and the 90s, which, you know, as someone in their early 30s, I only vaguely remember. So it doesn't have as much impact, for example, on millennials like me. So age is almost more important to look at than political party, I think, especially when you're looking at recreational or adult use legalization.
And Mona, I'm curious, in states you just spoke about how there have to be systems in place and routines, etc., when you legalize this drug for medical use, lots of decisions to make about how the public gets access to it, how to train doctors. How quickly in those states where this has been legalized for medical use, how quickly have doctors embraced its use and prescribed this drug?
You know, it's generally been slow to get doctors to embrace the use of this drug because there is a lack of science on it and a lack of clinical trial data on it, which is a result of federal prohibition. Because marijuana is Schedule I federally, it is very difficult for researchers to study the drug. The DEA has been sort of opening that up a little bit and licensing additional cultivators to cultivate cannabis for the purposes of research, but a lot of doctors are resistant to it because of the lack of research. And so it is slow to get there. A lot of states have training programs for doctors. A lot of states are allowing people like, you know, nurse practitioners also to certify patients to access the drug and things like that.
Because it's a federally controlled substance, I believe up until recently, there was only one legal grower of marijuana for research purposes, which has certainly limited the availability of the product for research. I think that's open. You just referred to the fact that it's opening up a little bit. Medically speaking, this is used to treat PTSD, cancer, sickle cell anemia, Crohn's disease, Parkinson's, and myriad terminal diagnoses, among other disease. And NC Health News reports that passage of our state's Compassionate Care Act that Senator Paul Lowe is focused on would itself be focused on very, very narrowly just on folks with chronic conditions and end-of-life care. How does that compare with how it's being used, Mona, in most states?
I think there's a wide range of states that have a wide range of restrictiveness on their medical cannabis programs. So I wouldn't say that most states are more or less restrictive, but just so you get a sense of the spectrum, you know, you have places like Oklahoma or California before they legalized adult use, where the medical marijuana programs were very unrestrictive. And a lot of people, it was very easy for people to access medical cannabis cards. You know, you can go to your doctor and you say you have chronic pain or you have anxiety, you can get a card. Oklahoma has the highest per capita rate of medical cannabis patients in any state of the nation right now, which is pretty remarkable and a testament to how, you know, kind of like a Wild West their medical program is. Then you have programs like Utah, which North Carolina's bill is modeled on, where it is much more restrictive. You have a very short list of qualifying conditions. And, you know, it's not something that like anybody could walk into their doctor and say, hey, I have anxiety, I need a medical cannabis card.
Senator, even though it's going to be difficult to get this through the legislature, let's talk about the slippery slope, because there are those people who say you legalize it for medical use, and that's just opening the door to recreational use, et cetera, et cetera. Do you see this as something that will lead to the expansion, if you are successful in passing it for medical use, to the expansion of the use of this drug elsewhere?
There is always that possibility. Without a doubt, I think that at some point, our state, like so many others, probably will have recreational cannabis. Will this bill lead to it? I don't know. But I think that it's becoming the way of the world. So it wouldn't, I would not be surprised at all.
And where do we stand with state law in terms of the criminalization of possession and or distribution of marijuana?
What I would say is, and I've said it to some folks that have asked me that, that's another bill. This bill seeks to make medical cannabis available to certain individuals with certain conditions. In terms of criminalization and these other kinds of things, that's another bill that's going to have to be written. Some time ago, I did write a bill to decriminalize small amounts of marijuana. But that's not what this bill seeks to do.
Right. There has been the availability of the sale of CBD products, which is another chemical extract from the plant that produces marijuana. Has the fact that that has now made its way into health food stores and other places where they dispense these products, has that greased the skids in any way for the medical use of marijuana, of cannabis itself, and the THC that it contains?
Are you asking me that
yes.
question?
Yes, sir.
I'm sure it plays a role. I don't know a whole lot about that side. I think that some of our other panelists might know more about that than I do. But I'm sure that it just being available in health food stores, and I see various other places that are popping up, you know, saying that they're selling hemp products.
Well, who would know?
I'm sure it makes it more acceptable.
Who would know the answer to that? Natalie, Mona, do you know the difference between the CBD and the THC chemical extracts of this plant?
I'm going to let Mona do that. She's the expert.
Okay, Mona, go ahead.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, so CBD is an extract of the hemp plant. The hemp plant is simply, both hemp and marijuana are cannabis. Legally speaking, cannabis or cannabis products with less than 0.3% THC is considered hemp under federal law. So that is not a federally illegal drug anymore. Once that goes above 0.3% THC, then the DEA considers that marijuana. However, you know, even if a hemp product is like, say, 0.5% THC or 0.7% THC, that's not necessarily going to be intoxicating. It can be if you're talking about like a large quantity of the product. I won't get into the weeds of like, you know, testing hemp products, but I think it has helped with a destigmatization of cannabis more generally. And CBD from a medical marijuana perspective is really highlighted in terms of treating, you know, children with epilepsy. I think that's a story that really brought this issue to the forefront. However, there are a lot of patients who say, well, just CBD isn't enough for me and I need more THC. And so I think it does help open the door to that discussion, but it is very distinct because CBD is not intoxicating and THC is an intoxicating compound.
Senator, under your bill, how would this product, if it successfully passes and is signed by the governor, how would you dispense the medical marijuana? Under what auspices? Who would control it? Would there be a government agency? Would it be under the ABC board? How would you do it?
There's a lot of details in this bill, and we certainly will not be able to go through all of the details of it. And we're still vetting it out. That's why it has gone through so many committees, to try to look at the best way to deal with this. Right now, it's modeled after the Utah bill, which is a vertical operation which kind of narrows things a lot in terms of how it's regulated, of how it's dispensed, of how it's processed. Those things are very, very narrow in this bill. And we feel that that's probably the best way at this time to get medical marijuana, make it available to our citizens.
You know. Because the enforcement of marijuana laws has resulted in the incarceration of Black people in much greater numbers than white people. Some see this, even the use of medical marijuana, as a social justice issue. Is that how you see it, Senator?
They probably, for many people, they probably walk down the same side of the street, and it is closely aligned. However, I think that from a criminalization, legalization, criminal justice standpoint, I think there's going to have to be some other legislation that directly deals with some of the activity that is surrounded marijuana. I think that that's another piece of legislation, and I'm not sure that this piece of legislation will answer, be the panacea for all of those things.
Well, given the fact that a lot of people find that to be a very important issue, the social justice aspect of this and other aspects of our criminal justice system, do you think that if this successfully passes and people become accustomed to this being a legal drug for medical use, that will naturally lead to a lessening of the stigma attached to it, which will then naturally lead to some sort of legislation in North Carolina to decriminalize the drug? I have 30 seconds.
I think it was Mona that talked about a lot of the hemp and a lot of other things that have happened have led to broader conversations. And I think this will as well.
I know you have an appointment to go to. I'm going to let you go, and we'll continue our conversation with Natalie Furtick and Mona Zhang when we come back. But Senator Paul Lowe from Forsyth County, thank you for joining us this morning. I appreciate it.
Invitation. Have a great day.
We'll come right back in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins, along with Natalie Furtick, federal cannabis policy reporter for Politico, and Mona Zhang, a state cannabis policy reporter for Politico. We're in the lightning round because I've got so many issues to hit in the next 20 minutes. I'm not sure we'll get to all of them, but we'll try. La Vida on Facebook writes, marijuana is less harmful than the use of alcohol, but alcohol is legal. Where is the common sense in that? Well, that's a constant refrain when we talk about this on this and other programs. But Mona, you report that in states where the legalization and decriminalization has been considered or has been passed, Democrats tend to see it through the lens of social justice, while Republicans regard it as a free market issue. Would the same be true of members of Congress? And if so, why has this legislation taken so long to get through? Because there's several bills in Congress, or have been, and I think are there now, that simply aren't making any progress.
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, I think state legislatures tend to be more productive in certain ways than Congress. I'll take Missouri as an example. I mean, right now there's an adult use legalization bill that is heading to the House floor, and it has the support of progressive Democrats who, you know, are concerned about a medical cannabis monopoly in the state, and they're supporting it for its social justice provisions and for its criminal justice provisions. And then you have the support of like very right-wing sort of free market libertarians who don't want to see license caps, who also don't want to see sort of like a monopoly or this creation of a big marijuana industry. And so they're coming at this from different sides of the aisle for different reasons, but they're supportive of the same policy. And the question of whether, you know, Congress could sort of get that sort of bipartisan support around a single bill, I think is more difficult. I mean, Natalie, I think you have more insight into, you know, what's holding up. I mean, where could we get some sort of compromise? Could we get 60 senators to agree on a cannabis legalization bill?
You want to comment,
I mean, I think that the things that are holding up the federal government on cannabis are the same things that are holding up the federal government on everything, which is that American voters, who technically are the ones that are, American voters are the bosses of everyone in Congress, and yet American voters defer to senators and lawmakers all the time and take them at face value and really don't vote to encourage bipartisanship at the federal level. It's so easy for a lawmaker to compromise on something and then to get hit by it, hit for making that compromise in order to get a bill passed, especially in their primaries. So I think that that is one of the biggest complexities right now of American politics at the federal level, that I think is really causing Congress to honestly often accomplish nothing, because they're so worried that if they give any tiny ground on the perfect way, in their opinion, to create a piece of legislation, whether it's cannabis or whether it's a number of other issues, that they're going to hit a primary and they're going to be challenged from, you know, if they're a Republican from further right, saying, how dare you give up this one small thing in order to accomplish like five other things that you wanted. And same from the left, how dare you give in to Republicans on something? Why didn't you hold out for exactly what we wanted you to do? And that's very much what's happening with cannabis. You know, you've got Senator Schumer and Senator Booker right now holding up a bill that would simply expand banking options for the cannabis industry, because as a federally illegal substance, most cannabis businesses cannot access bank accounts, like checking accounts, savings accounts, small business loans. And that bill is being held up because it doesn't have any criminal justice reform elements. So when the federal government gets to the point where it's considering broad legalization, it's going to be just an exponentially more egregious version of that kind of lack of compromise. And I want to be clear, that lack of compromise is reinforced by voters at the ballot box. So voters want people to compromise more on the federal level and work together to create laws. They must then reflect that when it comes to primaries and the general election. And until it happens, I don't know if it's going to change.
Mona, as North Carolina and South Carolina are considering medical marijuana bills, our neighbors to the north in Virginia have legalized marijuana for recreational use. What led them to that decision?
Well, I think it had to do in large part with the fact that in the last session, Democrats controlled both chambers of the legislature and the executive branch. And so they were able to push through a number of their priorities on the criminal justice front, including marijuana legalization. However, you know, Republicans took back the House of Delegates and the governor's office in the last election. So that's proving to hold out the rollout of the adult use market. So it will not launch. Recreational sales aren't going to launch as soon as a lot of proponents hoped, but it is still legal to possess and home grow and gift at the moment. So I think there's going to be a longer limbo period in Virginia now.
And there are other conservative states not in the South that are warming up to this legalization aspect. They include South Dakota, Mississippi, and Montana, which, of course, Mississippi is in the South. And we have this bill in our state that we've been talking about this morning, and another medical marijuana bill being considered in the South Carolina State House. After the South Carolina bill passed through their state Senate, it hit the House floor earlier this month. What would it legalize, and what are its chances for passage, do you think, Mona?
Well, South Carolina's bill is a pretty restrictive medical marijuana bill. But I think, you know, Natalie actually knows more about South Carolina than
okay.
I do.
Natalie?
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty similar bill to North Carolina's bill in terms of restrictiveness. I think that that's going to be the trend that you're going to see all across the South. Is, you know, the senator who was on earlier mentioned Utah, and I've done a lot of reporting on Utah, and it's a more sort of, you know, religious based mentality of let's do this compassionate care thing, but let's not go anywhere near legalization of something that could intoxicate people. The bill is definitely facing I think it has a better chance in the House. Most of my reporting that I've done throughout this year has been that the South Carolina bill has a slightly better chance than the North Carolina bill of making it all the way through both branches of, or both sides of the legislature. But it, you know, I think it's still going to be a tall lift in the House. It was more of a given in the state Senate. So we're going to see what happens.
But in America, money is where the rubber meets the road, and this will be a $33 billion industry this year. The bill proposed by Democrats in the U.S. House would decriminalize marijuana and tax it at 8%. Some Republicans are on board, although they're considering a lower tax rate on it. But can any state, can the federal government afford to sit out on this? When so much tax revenue at stake, Natalie?
So actually what's funny about that question is that the federal government is already making an enormous amount of tax revenue from the cannabis industry, because as an illegal substance, cannabis businesses are not allowed to write off almost any business expenses. Mm. So where a traditional business could write off pens and paper, and especially the products that it's buying to then sell. You know, if you're growing corn, you get to write off the seeds, because then you're using that to further your business. And then you pay taxes on the corn that is produced, but you get to subtract the price of the seeds, right? In cannabis, that's not true. So you have to buy all of these products, lights, rent, rent a building, et cetera, things that would usually be written off as a small business, you can't write off. So cannabis businesses are paying taxes on just their full, not their revenue, but just everything that they sell, every money, every penny that comes in the door. So the bill that you mentioned, the Congressional Budget Office always reviews bills and says this is how much money it will make or it will cost the federal government. And they did decide that if cannabis was federally illegal, the industry would grow enough over the next 5 to 10 years that it would make up for the loss of the revenue that the federal government currently makes from 280E. But I think it is important to recognize that while North Carolina is not making any tax revenue off cannabis right now, the federal government is making tax revenue off cannabis in 19 states aren't selling yet, but there's been 18 states that have legalized and Washington, D.C., and those businesses are legitimate businesses in those states, so they're paying federal taxes.
For many people, this, even after hearing this conversation, this may appear to be a no-brainer, that this is a good idea, for at least for the medical use, and perhaps even for recreational use. Why would you be against this, particularly when there's money involved? But there is, it turns out, a downside, which you have written about, Natalie. I believe I'm correct that you live in Washington State, and in the state just to your south, Oregon, they've had legalized cannabis dating back to 2014. That move was supposed to cause the black market in marijuana sales and distribution to dry up. It did not. In fact, you report that Oregon rivals California as a national center of illegal weed cultivation. Why?
Because states like North Carolina have not legalized it. North Carolina is actually one of the biggest imports of cannabis from California and Oregon. Oregon has almost done away with its in-state illegal market because Oregon is one of the states out west that has put the lowest taxes and the lowest regulatory hurdles on businesses getting into the cannabis industry. So cannabis is classic supply and demand. It's a very cheap product in Oregon compared to a lot of other places. So people just go to a dispensary and buy it because that's easy. They know it's tested and it's cheap. But Southern Oregon's a really rural place. There's a lot of trees. There's not a lot of people. Because cannabis is legal in Oregon, police can't just walk up and search a house because they see a cannabis plant. They need to know that there are more cannabis plants than are allowed under home grow laws. And then they need to know that that place doesn't have a license under the Oregon Liquor and Cannabis Commission to be growing cannabis for sale. And then they can go in. So that creates a system in which a lot of illegal farmers have gone into Oregon, some of them from California, because California has been cracking down on this more, but some of them from Israel, Russia, Eastern European countries, Mexico. You know, somebody told me that there's 30 languages being spoken in this very tiny rural part of Oregon, about 4.5 hours south of Portland. So, but that cannabis is being produced and it's not really being sold in Oregon. It's being sold in Illinois. It's being sold in New York State and New Jersey, who, while they've legalized, you know, New York still hasn't even started sales. It's being sold in North Carolina. It's being sold in Texas and Florida, places that have not legalized cannabis yet. People are still using cannabis and they're buying it from somewhere. So, and that somewhere often is Oregon and California.
So let's be clear, because Oregon has legalized it, there are legal farmers growing it and then selling it to the people who dispense it. But there are also in Oregon, but there is has also been this influx of illegal farming operations, which are off the map and off the grid. And you've used the word in your story, cartels, to describe this. And when you talk about drug cartels, you the mind conjures up this group of people who are incredibly violent and dangerous and who will do anything to protect their product and their profit. Is that what's been happening? Is that accurate in terms of what's happening in Oregon? And is it likely to spread elsewhere?
To answer to your first question, yes, that is accurate for what's happening in Oregon. I would say it's not to the point where they are attacking and killing local, you know, Oregonians, because that would draw a lot of police attention and they're really trying to stay under the radar. But there have been deaths of workers, many of whom have been brought often against their will across the border to work at these places. You know, there have been people who've turned up in unidentified graves, not locals. Again, they're often workers who've been brought in from other places. But there is a lot of fear in the area. There's a lot of intimidation. Some locals have talked about being threatened on their doorstep by someone with a gun who wants to steal their water. It hasn't erupted into outright violence against anyone who lives in Southern Oregon, but obviously no one is very happy that they're there and is having a bad time because they're there. In answer to your second question, no, it is not likely to spread very far outside of Oregon. And that's because of the nature of Oregon, Southern Oregon and Northern California. You know, I've been to North Carolina. You guys think you have rural places. It doesn't compare to Southern Oregon and Northern California. You are hours and hours from other people sometimes. I mean, you could scream and no one would hear you. Your closest neighbors are miles and miles away. And there's so many thick, dense. I mean, this is timber country, right? So you've got Douglas firs, you've got tall, tall evergreen trees and dense forests. And it's very easy to hide these types of products there. So, I mean, we see some illicit grows in Washington State, for example, but it's just not the same as Southern Oregon and Northern California. And, you know, you could say, well, Nevada's rural. Nevada doesn't have the types of trees that exist in Southern Oregon. It's much, much harder to hide a giant cannabis grow in a desert where someone can just fly over and see it. So it's sort of a very specific, there's a lot of elements that have come together to make Southern Oregon this place. The proliferation of the hemp industry in Oregon has also contributed to that, because those licenses are not listed on a central state database in the way that the cannabis industry is more highly structured and regulated than the hemp industry in Oregon. So that's created this other dynamic. And Oregon just also doesn't have a lot of money for law enforcement. It's not one of the nation's wealthier states. So California has been pouring money into taking on their illicit industry and in some ways driving those people into Oregon.
One more thing that I wanted to talk about, but that we won't have time to talk about, but that you've both reported on, is this fear among these ma-and-pa marijuana growers and operators that they will be put out of business ultimately by the corporatization of marijuana growing and sales, as most farming has already happened and most other things in this nation have become conglomerates. But that's a story for another day. Natalie Fertig, a federal cannabis policy reporter, and Mona Zhang, state cannabis policy reporter, both for Politico. Thanks for joining us. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.